Well, hey, thanks so much for attending the Horror Pod Class. We hope that you enjoyed I Madman tonight.
Yeah.
My name is Tyler.
I'm Warren.
And this is the Horror Pod Class. As you can see, tonight we are talking all about I Madman. And if we go to the next slide, you'll get a feel for what every episode kind of looks like. We're going to talk a little bit about what we've been watching, what we've been enjoying. Then we're going to talk about our essential question, which is essentially going to examine some of the pedagogical reasons why someone might show bits and pieces of I, Madman in the classroom.
Well, why not the whole thing?
Right. I got my film class that I've been working real hard to teach. So the first movie I'm going to screen is I, Madman. That's not true. No. I think Moms for Freedom or whatever that group that has infiltrated everybody's board meetings. We'll probably have some issues with that. And then we'll talk to you about some pairings that might go well with this movie. And then finally, we'll give you a little bit of idea of what we're going to screen next time. So with that in mind, Oren, what next slide and tell us what you're excited about.
So I can't remember because it's been 1,000 years since we were here last, it feels like.
Yeah, it does.
I did a bunch of stuff since then. I can't remember if I already talked about Clown on a Cornfield 2, but if I didn't, it's really good. I read it recently, and it's fantastic. It's by Adam Cesar. It's the sequel, obviously, to Clown on a Cornfield. That should be obvious anyway. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. it's fantastic. So I finished reading that earlier this month, and then I went to Panic Fest, which is all I can kind of remember because it was a lot. At Panic Fest, I saw a couple things that were good. I saw Birth Rebirth, which is really good, and very heavy, and Megalomaniac, which is also really good and even heavier. It's really hard to recommend to people because it's really brutal and unpleasant.
That's such a ringing endorsement.
I mean, I loved it, but it was fucking hard to watch, so...
My kind of movie, man. My kind of movie. I went to Panic Fest, and I think you can read up my kind of official cable from that festival. It's going to come out on Friday. The long and short of it is there was a lot of fun to be had. You reviewed Evil Dead for The Pitch, which is kind of our local rag here. It was fun, you know? It's not necessarily my thing, but...
I had fun.
Yeah, shares a lot of lifeblood with you, what makes the original so good. And my kind of connection, the big thing that I want to pump up, at least, is Agatha, which is a 50-minute rotoscoped animated movie that only played at Panic Fest virtually, and it is... bonkers. It is the coolest looking thing I've seen in a very long time because of the rotoscope. But I think it uses that type of animation to create atmosphere so well. I had a blast. I don't know what happens in the movie. Like, it is a wild, wild thing. But, it totally made Panic Fest worth it for me.
I haven't actually watched it yet. I mean, you mentioned it to me, but I haven't watched it yet. But, I watched like the trailer, and it looked like someone's homebrew like Silent Hill game.
That's exactly the kind of vibe that it's given off. So, and the other thing that bears mentioning, really important mentioning, Second Sight is kind of this boutique Blu-ray DVD company, and we've been working with them for a while, and they released two new things. The first is Texas Chainsaw Massacre, completely remastered with a half a dozen new interviews from all kinds of folks that were involved in the production, but also really cool filmmakers have contributed both to the interviews, but also the gigantic book and everything that comes with it.
It's in a huge-ass box.
Yeah. It is by far the absolute best release that I have seen of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Jill Gervazian, who's kind of our local celebrity, hell of a director, has a contribution for that book. So you can see what she's doing there. The other thing, I am a terrible, terrible horror movie aficionado because until I got the preview disc from Second Sight, I had never seen Picnic at Hanging Rock.
I actually still haven't.
My gosh. That thing is, I know here at Stray Cat, next month is going to be folk horror, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to celebrate all things kind of folk horror-y. And Picnic at Hanging Rock is like... the absolute weirdest end of kind of folk horror in general.
Yeah.
but it's got so much going on. I don't know why it took me so long to check it out. But again, with all their releases, absolutely stunning, stunning commentary from a couple of film critics. So Second Sight's where it's at. And if you're going to spend money on boutique stuff, spend it at Second Sight.
They have some really fancy releases.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Really cool shit. So, also, we need to screen Picnic at Hanging Rock sometime because it is very, very strange. Excellent. I love it. Well, if you need a copy, I got one for you. All right. Next slot. Oh, and I should say, we're giving out some copies of Unwelcome, which is a brand new movie that has come out. I have told everyone I know it's a lot of fun to watch. If you can get through kind of the first 5 or 10 minutes of utter brutality, it becomes more or less a Muppet movie. Who doesn't love a horror Muppet movie? And that's essentially what it is. So yeah,
like I remain angry that I have only heard about it from you because the monster senator are red caps and I don't understand why everyone hasn't been telling me about this.
Well, they should. I will be the first to say there are probably films that, you know, maybe a little more like highbrow or whatever, but for like 90 minutes of fun, and if you want to see like little kind of demon-y creatures run amok, like almost a Ghoulies-esque element to it, yeah, man, Unwelcome is a heck of a flick to catch. So, speaking of, let's go to our first giveaway. I think that's
which will probably be our only giveaway.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
Welcome. So here you go.
You just win by default.
Yeah.
We don't even have to draw.
No, I am. I'm not going to give you two copies
right,
of Unwelcome.
So let's make this into one pile. So
okay.
Let's do one giveaway. So let's take this and then we can give him these.
Love it.
One copy of Unwelcome.
Yep.
You could give them the book or not. That's
yep,
your
yep,
call.
Yep, yep, yep.
Oh, no, that's Daniel Krause now. Well, that's excellent. Hey,
oh, wow,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Coming. All kinds of good problem. Stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We appreciate it. All right. So let's get into tonight's conversation, shall we? Here is our essential question.
I think.
Coming?
Yes.
Yeah. How did you read it? I think you can.
No.
All right. Hey.
So how did the history of the pulps shape our current understanding of literary genre?
Yeah.
Can read, as
oh,
it turns
yes,
out.
Yes. And Oren has passed the first test today. So, okay.
They say that if you want to escape reality, all you really have to do is pick up a good book.
Why don't we just take it from the top, okay?
It all started with the book. One minute I was reading about him, and the next minute he was standing right next to me.
But when the escape becomes an obsession,
this crap.
I can't stop.
It is the return to reality that becomes the challenge.
Why would anybody do such a thing?
Because he thinks that it will please me.
Lovely.
What is happening to you?
Damn it, Richard, listen to me. I'm telling you, there's going to be another killing tonight.
You can't stake out every building in the city based on some cryptic passage from a 30-year-old novel.
Going down.
Just read the book, Richard, please.
You will love me.
I, Madman, read any good books lately?
So, Oren, this was a first watch for me. So, why I Madman? I'm still asking why I Madman.
I really like this movie. So I am a big fan of The Gate, which I know you are also a big fan of. And Tibor Takacs, the director of The Gate, has not directed... I mean, he's directed a ton of other movies, but most of them are not memorable, we'll say.
Fair.
But this one is, weirdly. And... I had not seen it for a long time, I hadn't seen it or even really heard much about it until some people were talking about it online, and they hooked me in with the fake book covers and things.
Oh,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when I learned that there was like a stop motion Jackal Boy in it, I was sold.
That's all it takes.
Yeah, that's all it takes. I watched it and I kind of fell in love with it. I actually maybe like it more than The Gate. Just because it's so weird. It's so weird.
Yeah. and that's the thing, right? I don't think of it tries to wrap up any of the loose ends. It's just like, here's all the loose ends. And
I mean, I sort of love that it does not explain at all
anything
why this is happening. Yeah,
right. Like there's
like
some...
it's clear what is happening. Why? No idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and now this is my, I think, third or fourth watch through this film. And I didn't put it anywhere in the slideshow, but I definitely think it bears at least a little bit of a conversation. This is a giallo film, right?
I mean, sort of. Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely giallo elements. Absolutely.
Right? It's got our masked bad guy, our kind of sweet ingenue. It's got a murder mystery of sorts, right? Like, it's kind
of got inept
chicken.
Detectives, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, right? Like, it is, it's got some police procedural to it. So it's nice to see all of that kind of come around and be like, oh, yeah.
I mean, something I really love about it, it's so, like, it's very clearly one of those movies that got made because Nightmare on Elm Street made a bunch of money. Like,
yeah.
It's very obvious that that's why this movie got financed. And, I mean, like, the screenwriter is the screenwriter of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, I want to say.
Oh.
So,
that's,
I mean,
the,
like,
bad one, though.
Yeah. just one of them. I don't fucking know which one. Doesn't matter. No,
that's fair.
Not the first one. Eh, beyond that, who cares? but like, it's clearly doing that thing, right? It's doing that same thing. But it's doing it very differently. Like, there was a shit ton of Nightmare on Elm Street clones that came out after Nightmare on Elm Street. Like just like Evil Dead, just like Jaws, just like, you know, whatever. Like, it spawned a whole subgenre of movies that were basically just Nightmare on Elm Street clones. And most of them are taking different aspects of Nightmare on Elm Street than what this is taking. And this is doing something very different
yeah.
than Nightmare on Elm Street or than any of those movies. Even while it's doing something similar with the, you know, the girl who's the only one who can see the guy, essentially,
yeah.
and all this stuff. But it's doing almost a giallo thing with it. It's doing this very, like, 1950s throwback scenes, which are adorable,
yeah.
by the way. I love them.
Yeah, they really are. They're cozy, yeah.
Also, I did not remember at all when I scheduled this movie for April that it's a Christmas movie.
Oh, I know,
until
right?
I was rewatching it, and I was like, fuck, this takes place at Christmas. Good.
Yeah, we'll just have to keep it in our back pocket if we ever run out of that kind of stuff. Yeah, but, I mean, if she doesn't close the book after every kind of, like, vignette, but she wakes up, this is like a Nightmare on Elm Street movie, right?
Yeah.
And, like, I think he needs to make maybe some more jokes or whatever, but...
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, you do have the thing where, like, he talks... which separates him from a lot of the slashers who don't, like, just like Freddy Krueger.
Right.
Know, he talks and carries on a banter, even if it's not as jokey, with his victims.
Understandably, I'm looking at it through, like, a modern viewpoint, but, like, that whole, like, be my lover, you know, that kind of vibe, I'm getting, like, some Candyman stuff from it, too, right? Like, there is this kind of love... interest, so it's not just murder, it's this kind of obsession.
Although I think this came out before Candyman, actually.
Yeah, oh, yeah, most definitely. I think so, too. Yeah,
I think this was 89 and Candyman was 90, maybe. Sounds right. I don't know.
Yeah, feels right.
Sure.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Very good. So, talk to us a little bit about Randall William Cook.
So Randall William Cook, I was not aware of all of this at once until I was doing the research for this episode. Like, I knew that I loved this movie in part because of the Jackal Boy and how much the Jackal Boy reminded me of the special effects from The Gate. And both of those movies, the special effects in them have a very unique tone. No other movie really looks or feels quite like them.
Yeah.
And I knew I loved that, and I knew that they had the same special effects person. I did not realize how much other stuff he had done. So Randall William Cook is clearly the villain in this film. He is also the guy who did special effects for the Jackal Boy. He also did the stop-motion effects in The Thing and Cue the Winged Serpent.
I love Cue the Winged Serpent. That's a wild one, yeah.
He created the Terror Dogs in Ghostbusters. He worked on Fright Night. Of course, he worked on The Gate. Later, he did a bunch of Full Moon movies. He worked on Puppet Master 2 and 4. He worked on Dr. Mordred, which we've shown here at the Horror Podcast before.
Yeah.
And then, much later... he won 3 Academy Awards for the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Can you imagine that, right? Like, what a trajectory, right?
Yeah. It makes me wish I still worked at a video store so I could do an end cap themed around this guy so people could come in and be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, right. You could just, like, do the book covers, like, the evolution. You'd be like, yeah. Like, he kind of figured it out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, at the same time, you can kind of see, like, you can kind of see the Lord of the Rings effects in the Jackal Boy. Like, you can see that similar, like the cave troll and the Jackal Boy, like they have a similar aesthetic going on. Like,
well, and gait, I think and which is really wild, right? Because, I mean, these guys are stop motion, and that's clearly CGI, but you can still see maybe that motion capture, the thing that he was going for. But yeah. I mean, Jackal Boy's rough. He's a scary looking dude. So, I don't know. Maybe next Halloween. Next slide.
And so then I also just needed to stop and point out, because I was looking up Tibor Tekax, and he looks like a character from like a police procedural TV show. Look at him.
Yeah.
Like, 100%, if you're listening to this online, like, go find a picture of Tibor Tekax as he is now. He looks exactly like he shows up in, like, Castle or NCIS or some shit.
Oh, for sure. and he could play multiple characters, right? He could be the guy who is orchestrating the bad deal, but I could also see him being, like, the undercover cop that they have planted
or like a PI or something. Yeah. Like, he 100% looks like a Hollywood PI.
So that's going to be our story, that... Is it Tibor or Tibor?
I don't know.
All right. Tibor?
I don't know if that's it, but I'd like to say that. Tibor.
I like it.
Ah, Tibor.
Yeah,
Tibor. How many times you saved my butt?
Tibor, his part-time job must be, solving crimes.
Yeah.
So 100%. Very good.
I mean, you know, bad movies only pay so much.
Right. You trying to tell me this movie didn't make him rich? I don't know. I don't know about that. Okay. So... the selling point of this movie, I think, for both of us, but particularly for you, were these wonderful kind of throwback book covers to a fundamentally different time, right?
Yeah.
So you talk to us about the fake pulp novels in this.
So, I mean, again, they were what, like, got me to watch it in the first place. Like, the first thing I ever saw from this movie was, I think, maybe the screen cap I used here, but, like, one of the screen caps that's just one of the old... pulp novel covers that they made up for it that look weirdly credible. Like, most of the time when movies do old-fashioned, like, pulp stuff, it looks like a modern thing doing pulp stuff. These actually look like pulp covers. Like, these are very credible. Like, the art style very much looks like 50s art style.
Yeah.
The titles, of course, are, one of them's the title of the movie, the other one is taken from Poe's Conqueror Worm poem. But they're just very good, like, fake book covers. They look so credible.
Yeah. And I think a thing that we have mentioned here before, like that whole kind of evolution of the pulps, the evolution of the comic books, and eventually the introduction of the code and all that kind of jazz. Like, these covers are salacious. That's what's so wonderful about them, right?
These are like spicy, weird mystery horror covers. Yeah,
yeah, right? Like... And we'll get to this in just a moment, but, like, they grasp, they get the attention of probably adolescent males, but anybody that would be interested in that. And, like, of course, like, 2020s Tyler is going to be like, those are attractive people and going to want to watch more of that. 1980s Tyler is like, oh, okay, I want to look at the movie covers and who's naked on that, right? 1950s cover, you know, or 1950s Tyler would be like, holy geez, what is this jackal with this woman who's half undressed? Yeah. Sign me up for that, whatever that may be, right?
Yeah, and I did, I put the note in, I wanted to mention, like, the working title of the movie was actually a hardcover, which I actually think is a better title than the one they went with, although the director apparently liked this one way more. So I guess he's wrong.
Yeah, I could see either.
You can find, like, key art that still has the hardcover title. I didn't use any of it in here, but there is some online.
I like it. I like it. Well, I think maybe now might be a good time to talk to us. We've used this term a handful of times, and our listening audience at home or here in the audience may not necessarily have as much experience in the world and realm of pulp fiction, but can you talk to us a little bit about what it is when we say what the pulps are?
Yeah. So actually threw into the slide like a whole big long thing they found on the Library of Congress because I think it's pretty good. So the Library of Congress definition, as it were, is the pulps, so-called because they were printed on cheap, high-acid content paper, served as popular reading material similar to today's paperback. Cheap, portable, disposable, and often sensational. The genre flourished from the 1920s to the 1950s. Titles focused on specific literary types, which we'll get back to in a minute, romance, sports, western, detective, science fiction, horror, or military. And notably, like, the thing about the Pulps and the thing that we'll talk about here in a minute is that prior to, I mean, they're descendants of the Penny Dreadful, which then became the Dime Novel, which then became the Pulps. Prior to those things, all of those things, like, books were expensive. Normal people couldn't afford them, for the most part. Like, they might have a few, but the idea of just, like, working class people being able to read for pleasure was kind of outside their reach for the most part, which was part of what kept a class division in place. So, like, when Penny Dreadfuls, when dime novels, when pulps all came out, like, it helped to push not just literacy, but, like, reading for the fun of reading.
Yeah.
Into the scope of normal people, of you know, non-educated people, not like college-educated people, anyway.
Yeah, dare I say it democratized reading, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, and more importantly, still to this day, I think the most popular book or whatever is the Bible. But hands down, if you did have a book in your household, it was the Bible, right?
Right.
So you have this kind of like Judeo-Christian ethic in the 40s and the 50s and the early 60s. And then you get this bombardment, this access to all this cool shit that suddenly your kids are reading. And now we are starting to see the kind of roots of the cultural crisis of the 1960s. And dare I say, resembles a lot of the cultural crisis I think that we're going through right now. Yeah. And I think that could be because we are finally now democratizing other forms of content. And we'll get to that here in just a second. I think the only other thing here is, as you can tell from this picture, Argosy was one of the big main...
Argosy was one of the biggest of the pulp magazines, kind of one of the first all-story ones. Like, they were mixed, a lot of them, but Argosy became the Argosy all-story because it was all fiction. And, you know, it was kind of one of the biggest ones. And I just pulled it because it... The covers look a lot like the covers from iMad, and there's a lot of other covers that do too, like Astounding Stories covers look like this
too.
Yeah,
those are great, yeah.
You know, they have that kind of red across the top and the very sort of salacious, lurid kind of painting and everything.
And very obviously, I think the one that probably everyone is familiar with is Tales from the Crypt, and, you know, mm-hmm. like all the Terror Tales and the other stuff that came out from that. Yeah. Very good. All right. So... We're going to talk some now about genre in general. And the first example, I think, is that of horror, right? That's the one that we love, and that's the one that I think we'll probably talk the most about. But one of the things I talk about at Monsters 101 is that horror and genre in general can get away... It can get away with not being traditional because it's all about subverting the traditional. It's all about being outside of the kind of dominant culture, right? Yeah. So... we see in this particular movie two people sleeping together, definitely not married, right? And contextually, if we're talking late 80s, right? Like, we're still kind of hardcore into the traditional family values of the late 80s.
I mean, you even have the discussion about whether or not they're going to get married, like, early on. Like, you know, the friend brings it up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yeah.
And she poo-poos it, right? Like, very woman in control, women in power, right? Despite kind of maybe some of the other imagery that this movie gives to our main character. Like, she's like, I don't even know if I want to do that. Like, I'm not really ready for that. And I think that is what is remarkable about the genre is you could fit in all kinds of shit like that.
Yeah.
And we don't even think twice because there's already a guy cutting off his body parts and selling on
right.
other people. So it's like the least of our concern is that, you know, they're kind of getting some on the side or whatever. and the other thing I think is pretty present in this, but definitely in the Nightmare on Elm Street that we talked about earlier, is the dark humor that can come along with this. Like, there's some funny shit in this movie. Like, the Jackal Boy is goofy looking, right? Like, and... The dark humor that it allows us to explore, I think, is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, very good. Next. All right. So, let's talk about the different types of genres as the pulps have provided us.
Yeah. So, I just pulled literally the list from the Library of Congress, which was horror, which is obviously the one we love here. Detective, which has sort of over the years become a broader genre that's mystery, thriller, spy, all that stuff. But in the 20s and 30s, it was pretty heavily detectives. Romance, which is still one of the most popular genres, and is still regarded as a very disposable genre, a genre where you churn out cheap paperbacks rather than lasting hardbacks. Like, you don't see the sort of boutique presses that we have for horror for romance, really. It's still very much just a pulp genre to a large extent. I mean, not to knock it in any way. That's just that's just the marketplace.
Well, I mean, the most famous romance novelists, right? You know, Danielle Steele or any of those other folks that I am blanking on. Like, they'll put out 4 or 5 books a year.
Yeah.
Like,
and while they do put them out in hardcover, like, they primarily sell in mass market paperback. Like, yeah.
And as a writer, like, I feel like getting a book out a year is pretty good, you know? So,
more than I usually manage.
Yeah, like, I just think that's it's hard. Yeah. So.
And then science fiction and fantasy, which the Library of Congress just lists science fiction, but they often get lumped together, even in bookstores, even today.
Mm-hmm.
Western, which at one time was an incredibly popular genre, both in books and movies, not so much anymore for various reasons. And then sports and military, again, not as much fiction about those things, although they're still very, very popular nonfiction topics today. And then one they didn't list, which kind of grows out of romance and bleeds into all the others, was spicy things. Back in the days of the pulps, they had lots of spicy mystery, spicy this, that, and the other, which were smut, essentially. They were softcore. They were like the Skinamax of pulp novels, right? They weren't like full-on pornography, although you could get that too, just, you know, you had to do it on the table. But they were, you know, they were sexy.
Yeah.
They were titillating. And you'd get like spicy horror, spicy mystery, spicy every genre, more or less.
Yeah. Well, and I think what is so interesting, right, is because they are operating outside of the canon or whatever we want to call it, that means that you can have those crossovers, right? You can have a really successful book series like the True Blood series, which is definitely a romance novel built in a horror universe, which like helps explain why it was so goddamn popular, right? Because you pull in all of these disparate audiences into this particular place.
Yeah,
I would be really remiss if I didn't mentioned that my like first real exposure to adult books, my mother loved Stephen King and Harlequin novels. So I would steal like the Stephen King and read all of that. And then I would go through like the mountains of paperback Harlequin novels and like only read the sex scenes. You
Which
know?
I think is what most people do with Harlequin novels. I mean, even the people who read them, like.
Right. Like you kind of skim through the plot. And the only thing that I will say is, and not to get on any kind of soapbox, because I definitely do not want to do that. But like, I don't know. I have a teenager, right? I have not necessarily had a conversation with like what he's watching on his phone or whatever. I'm certainly welcome if he would like to, but I definitely don't think he wants to. But I can tell you it is probably a little less, like my first exposure to that was through a romance novel, right? And as ridiculous and silly as sex scenes are in that, they're specifically written for an audience that doesn't want to read like hardcore pornography, right? So it is this more romanticized vision of the way that is. So like when I was a kid, I'm like, oh, okay, this is what sex is. I wonder without that kind of soft influence, like what that does to a, you know, prepubescent, you know, male or female. But I think really fondly of my time in all of those adult genres that I was not necessarily supposed to read yet. So
a little tangent, but I remember from high school, one of the only things I remember from my writing teacher in high school was he told me this story one time that he had a friend who wrote basically like pornographic books on the side. Like that was how he made a living.
Okie dokie.
He was a full-time writer, but like his named stuff, just like any fucking full-time writer pretty much, is his stuff that bore his name could not turn him a living. So for a sideline, he wrote pornography. And the only thing I remember is the guy supposedly said, you know, it's really simple. You just get, you know, you get into a rhythm of doing it, as it were.
Yeah.
But you know, you
interesting choice of words there, Oren.
But you it's very repetitive is the thing. Just like a lot of the genre is, just like a lot of pulps are, it's very repetitive.
Right.
And so he had this formula that he supposedly did, which was that every 10 pages, one per version.
Oh, all right. I like it.
Which I've always remembered.
Yeah, he's given himself that room to grow, right? And he's like, okay, all right. I like it. Yeah, man, like, not to derail the conversation completely, but like, pornography is its own genre,
oh, yeah,
right? Absolutely. Like, and arguably the most popular genre, you right, know? Like, yeah. Everybody is.
I mean,
you know.
And to actually bring pornography back around to what we're actually talking about, which is that the thing that separated genre to a large extent, like, again, before the pulps and before the penny dreadfuls, we didn't really have it. There really wasn't such a thing as genre. Books were just books. Genre is much, very much a marketing concern. It was not really a concern that books had when they were not mass marketed. And the thing that really separated the genre books from other books and movies and everything since is that they were marketed as entertainment rather than education or
sure.
or something that would make you better in some right. way. They were just for you to enjoy, which is itself subversive, right? Like,
sure.
especially in America, where we have this very Puritan ethic, especially into the 1950s, the idea that you did something just because you wanted to, like, it did not have intrinsic value.
Especially if it was salacious.
Right.
Right? Like,
and,
it's masturbatory, and oh, right. my God, in the 50s.
Yeah. And, like, the pulps are disposable, just like early comic books were. They are not intended to be kept. They're printed on paper that will decompose.
Yeah.
Like, they're not, they're temporary, they're just frivolous, temporary entertainment.
The
and that
pieces
is,
of candy.
Yeah, and that is very, again, that is itself inherently subversive to some yeah. extent compared to what had come before.
I like it. All right, so that's what came before. So let's talk about what came after, all right? So on this slide, I say TikTok and the new genres, but really TikTok is a stand-in for any main content driver, right? So yeah. YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Reels, I don't know, whatever the hell you're watching, chances are you have encountered some of these new genres, right? So obviously horror is still around. In fact, we were prepping for this episode. I think I sent you a TikTok. It was just a weird, creepy, like 30-second TikTok,
yeah.
but it was so good. And what I will say is my high school kids are absolutely in love with horror content delivered in this way. And the weird thing is, and I don't know what to do with this, they love watching digital content that looks like analog stuff. And I don't know, it's cool and it's scary and I dig it, but it is not necessarily something I would think that they were so into, but absolutely bonkers about.
Yeah, I mean, so. I don't have as much exposure to the young people as you do.
The young people.
But yeah, I mean, it definitely seems that way. Like, there's definitely this huge resurgence among in like affection for analog or analog, faux analog stuff.
Right.
Even among people who are not old enough to remember analog stuff.
Like, yeah, right. There's no way. Like
to have grown up with it, I mean. You know,
yeah.
like they may remember it. But
my six-year-old, probably this is a larger indicator of me being a bad dad than anything else, but like my six-year-old wants to have conversations about the back rooms, you know? And like we were walking to a restaurant, but it was in a strip mall, and all the lights were on, and they had gutted the inside of it to do something else. And he was like, "That's like the back rooms." And I was like, "Oh, I'm really proud of you, but also maybe not everybody feels that way." So yeah, I mean, horror is a genre that is sticking for sure, right? On this slide, I replaced the detective with the true crime genre because, like, right now, everybody is going bonkers about it.
Yeah. I mean, and there's, like, every other podcast. Every podcast that isn't two white dudes jawing about horror movies is a true crime podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just thick on the ground. Like,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, and documentaries and miniseries and all kinds.
Yeah. And I, to be honest, this could be its own episode, but like, I feel really iffy about all of that because a lot of like the victims of those peoples are still like floating around,
it's
and certainly
super,
the families
are. It's super
easy
to not be as careful as you should be
yeah.
when doing something like that. I know, like I get hired to write, you know, true crime content every now and then. And yeah, like, especially when you're writing like you know, you have a limit. You're writing like 1,000 words, or you're doing like a, you know, you're doing like a one podcast episode that's 30 minutes long or whatever, right? Like, it's really easy to not be as careful as you need to be when talking about real people who, you know, probably got killed or something, right? Yeah. Like,
whose families are still alive, right? And, you know, could be like, oh, apparently somebody's talking about the guy that killed my sister or whatever. Right. You know, like, So, and we talked about spicy. I've added a spicy category here. Like TikTok, I think, has become very famous for people dancing, and you know, I think that's how it got its start.
Yeah. Like, and both like the stuff I see in Reels a lot, anyway, is like not just the sexy posts of people dancing or just looking sexy and not doing anything.
Right.
But like a lot of like risque jokes and like people talking very frankly about sex, which I think is probably really good actually, because I think there was a ton of like misinformation about sex when I was a kid.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Nothing but misinformation, right?
And the idea of like people being very frank about sex is probably really refreshing actually.
Well, especially when you consider there is an active movement, you know, to get rid of any kind of conversation about sex or any of the, you know, the kind of complicated parts of all of that in our public schools. So, you know, thank God there's Dr. Ruth on TikTok that is willing to, it's not Dr. Ruth anymore, but, you know, whatever the equivalent. Right. So the other thing that I think I've seen a lot more of is AI generated content. Like the thing that I keep seeing on TikTok, maybe this is just my particular algorithm that's feeding it to me, but it's like, here's a really famous song and we fed the lyrics into an AI generator and we're going to play the AI pictures alongside the, which I think is an interesting idea, but also really weird because it removes any kind of vestige of like human contact in that way, right? It is just a computer giving me cool shit to look at, which is problematic on its own.
Yeah, AI gets into a whole difficult area that we do not have room
to I could talk for 90 minutes about ChatGPT, both the pros and the cons and all that jazz, especially as it impacts us teachers. The other thing, cooking, there are cookbooks, right? I think that's certainly pulpy. And
I mean, there's lots of cooking, like TikToks and those fucking recipe blogs that are like 9 paragraphs about your grandma.
Right, and then you get to the recipe at the,
there's definitely still tons of that.
Yeah. And then I think our final category here is kind of our catch-all for...
Yeah, just through a bunch of other stuff that I know shows up a lot.
Yeah, like makeup reviews and pranks.
Like beauty tips and stuff. And then people playing pranks on one another. Man, there's tons of those.
Fails, right? Like my sons are always like, look at this guy falling on some ice. And I'm like,
it's
funny.
Like America's Funniest Home Videos,
I guess. A lot of it is repurposed. Like it still has the logo in it. And I'm like, some dude just held his phone up to like the computer. You know, and is throwing this shit on in TikTok, making a lot more money than me.
Yeah,
hey, whatever, it's fine.
And then videos of people's pets, of course.
Of course, of course. Like, we always have room for people's pets. So, very good. All right. So, if we were gonna show a double feature, what?
Because we're not doing that.
Yep. What are the movies that you picked?
So I picked Mad Love from 1935.
I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, it's really good. We're gonna show it in the future at some point.
Okay.
Maybe for next Valentine's Day, we'll see.
All right.
But no, it's one of the many adaptations of a story called The Hands of Orlok.
Okay.
Which is about a concert pianist who gets his hands cut off and replaced with the hands of a killer.
Oh. All right.
It's been remade many times. And this is one of the remakes. It's not actually the original, but it's probably the best one. It's got Peter Lorre in one of his better roles. It's but the reason it's on here is the character Peter Lorre plays is this guy who is obsessed with the wife of said concert pianist.
Okay.
Who essentially uses this whole scenario to try and win her through a variety of really elaborate, weird ruses that resemble like the dude cutting his nose off and shit. He doesn't quite cut his nose off, but I mean it's.
It's unrequited love, and then
and
desperate.
And there is limbs getting cut off, hands at least getting cut off, just not his.
Okay. So, it's fair.
But yeah, it's really good.
All right, so that is a very Oren pick. What I think, not necessarily an Oren pick, is Wes Craven, or you know, your second. I don't want to step on
Go ahead. No, but Wes Craven's New Nightmare from 1994. again, this is very much obviously a Nightmare on Elm Street clone, this movie we watched, though it's much better than most of them and very different from Nightmare on Elm Street. It's definitely in that genre. And specifically, this one reminded me of the New Nightmare because of New Nightmare's focus on the actress from the first movie.
Oh,
name I am blanking on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanted to say Nancy Kerrigan. That's not it.
Nancy was her character's name.
Heather Langenkamp. Thank you. So good. Yeah. That's, yes.
Yeah. It's focused on her and Freddy's relationship with her,
okay.
Where he is specifically targeting her, in this case not due to unrequited love, but because she's his nemesis in the movie that he's
right.
from. And the way that sort of specific antagonism reflects the way that this guy is specifically, like, killing off the friends of and stalking and showing up for and so on and so forth.
Well, and it's been a while since I've seen that movie, but, like, it's her belief in him, right? It's like, it's kind of, she helps manifest him, right?
Right?
And
yeah.
that's maybe what happens in I Met. There is a way to read that movie that
sure.
happens.
That cop so got fired. Her cop boyfriend got so fired after that, like, when he had to go back and explain what happened. Yeah, he turned into a bunch of pages of book. Yeah. Fuck it, I quit.
Yes, I definitely shot something three times, because, he's done. So maybe he can turn to writing or something.
Yeah.
Okay, so I picked Waxworks from 1988, one of my absolute favorites. I felt like the kind of vignettes that they pop in and out of in that movie kind of reflect the vignettes in I, Madman. It's also got this kind of whimsy to it that I found incredibly charming, that I think probably share some lifeblood with this film, too. And then, a little more controversial, I picked the James Wan film from 2021, Malignant, because it has those same kind of roots that we talked about earlier in Giallo. The bad guy kind of vaguely resembles him with the trench coat, maybe.
Yeah. I can see it.
But it's also got, like, an unreliable narrator, right? Like, I don't know if she's crazy. I don't really know what's going on. I still don't know how reliable the narrator is from I, Madman. I'm just pretty sure it wasn't a conjoined twin that did all this.
Probably not.
But also, if it popped out at the last second, I'd be like, oh, okay.
Sure.
Yeah,
there was a Jackalboy, so, you know, who knows? Why, maybe.
Right.
I do love... Not to get on this topic right as we were ending, but I do love the fact that the protagonist in I, Madman is just a fucking idiot. Like, I love her, but she is dumb as a rock.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it's not annoying like it normally is when mm-hmm. characters are dumb in movies. Like, she's just sort of believably stupid. Like, she's just not very smart.
Yeah.
And she does a lot of things that are not very smart, but they seem like something a person would do who
sure.
wasn't very smart.
Yeah. Well, and it somehow manages to be independent.
Yeah.
And have her own thing going while still not being, like, overly bright, right?
Yeah.
There are plenty of stupid people that, like, have jobs, and it doesn't speak to a gender type of way of which they're acting. But, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, in her defense, she's trying to navigate a unnavigable situation, right? Like, there's no solution to this.
Right. Like, if this happened to you or I think
we'd be fucked.
We would call our detective boyfriends, and hopefully they would fucking help us out, because there's nothing we could do about it. So, all right. So, talk to us. It's been a long time coming. Warren.
I'm finally going to make Tyler watch Catermass in the Pit.
Nice. Time. Very good. That's what we're showing next time. Here at Stray Cat, it's part of their Folk Horror Month. Give us a real, again, this will be a first watch for me. I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah.
What's the elevator pitch here?
So Catermass the Pit is the third of three Catermass stories written by Nigel Neal. It's probably the most famous. It's arguably the best. It's about an excavation they're digging up a subway line and they uncover an alien spacecraft, basically.
Oh,
and it gets
okay.
so much weirder than that. Just a million times weirder than that.
Okay. I'm down. I love the art there. So very good. Okay. Well, we hope that you will join us on May 25th here at Stray Cat Film Center. A special thank you to Andrew for hosting and being our host the last... it's been about a year now, I think, that we've been in and around. So... We appreciate, you know, Stray Cat letting us do, letting us do our thing. If they want to, if the audience wants to find more of your stuff, Oren, where are they going to find you out on the World Wide Web?
I am Oren Gray on pretty much everything that I'm on. Twitter, for the moment, it continues to just disintegrate day by day. Letterboxd, Facebook, Instagram, all those places. And at orangray.com.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can find me on Twitter. I really am not on there much anymore. Since they got rid of my blue check, I never had a blue check mark. I never had a...
you can easily get a blue check
for
mark
for $9.
Now.
Yeah, but what the fuck ever. Elon Musk doesn't need my money. I hate that guy.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Yeah, fuck that guy. He's never invited on this show. You hear that, Elon? You can't come. Now, if he gives me $1 billion, we're going to have him on.
We don't even care what your fucking favorite movie is, Elon.
Yeah, right? It's probably something stupid. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can find more of my stuff. I'm at Letterboxd, a little bit on Twitter, but mostly I'm running the show at SignalHorizon.com. So if you want to write about kind of the same stuff that we've talked about today, if you want to look at the smarter side of horror, if you just want some stuff to review, or you think there's a classic that is underrepresented, reach out. I am Tyler at SignalHorizon.com. We're always looking for writers. We are a paying market. So come on. Let me see what you got. And if you don't want to write for us, then definitely come out May 25th for Catermass and The Pit.
It's going to be super good.
Until then, class dismissed.